From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thomas Francis Marr's story ended in Montana with a mystery. He was 43 when he disappeared in 1867, but by then he had led quite a life, more than one, really. Timothy Egan says Marr lived a dozen lives. He was an Irish revolutionary whose words inspired an uprising against the English. He was banned to Tasmania, where he made a daring escape to the United States, where he became a Civil War hero before he made his way west. And that's where Egan says he was looking for another cause, or at least a coda of grand consequence. Timothy Egan is joining us today to talk about Thomas Francis Marr. In his book, he says Marr's life is the story of Ireland. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a theme in the life of Thomas Francis Marr that you can find in Timothy Egan's book about this remarkable man. Marr, by the way, was an Irish revolutionary, an escaped fugitive, and a U.S. Civil War hero who died in the Montana Territory at 43. He lived, according to Egan, a dozen lives, but every time he seemed settled, every time he seemed comfortable in his life, he refused to stand still. As a young Irish student sent to school in England, Marr was surrounded by the trappings of the world's foremost power. And Egan says his family had money. He could have slid into the family business, he writes, could have lived in the biggest house and never be cold and never break a sweat, never be hungry. Yet when he died in the Montana region, he was practically broke, but not without a cause and not without something to say. Today in the program, Timothy Egan is joining us to talk about Thomas Francis Marr. His book is The Immortal Irishman, the Irish revolutionary who became an American hero. Timothy Egan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a columnist now for The New York Times. He's written a number of books. Among them is The Worst Hard Times about the Dust Bowl, which won the National Book Award. He's joining us today from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle. And Timothy Egan, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. It's great to be with you.
I want to begin with something that you've talked about. When you came across this story of Thomas Marr, you said that you had been looking for a way to tell the Irish story. Give me a sense what you mean by that.
Well, you know, I'm somewhat of a lapsed Irish American. I'm Irish on both sides of my family. My mother's side is from Montana. They were sort of the Butte Irish, which was – they were drawn to the mines there, as many Irish were also drawn to the mines of Utah. But I was somewhat of a lapsed. I took a couple classes in college, so I knew a little bit of the history of English oppression and that. But I was looking for – I went to Ireland with my family just before my mom died, my daughter and my siblings, and I come from a big family of nine people. And we were very moved by the traditional stories and the music we heard in the pubs and going to the jails, which is a thing you do in Ireland. You go to the prisons and imagine what it was like to be a political prisoner. So I was looking for a way to tell this larger – the story of the Irish American diaspora and how we came to be. You know, everybody wants to know their story. Yeah. And I thought I was going to write a famine book because there's been so much new scholarly information in the last 20 years about what we now know to be essentially a crime of neglect that killed almost a million people.
Which we'll get to, by the way. It's a fascinating part of the story.
Right. And so – but, you know, here's the thing that I'm so lucky with in my writing career is that I think to be – a storyteller, you have to be open to sort of serendipity, opening to things happening. You can't plot things. So I was with the Montana governor, Brian Schweitzer, ex-Montana governor, some time ago, and outside of the state capitol in Helena, and there's this massive equestrian statue with the sword thrust looking at the Rockies. And at the base of this statue are these incredible fighting words from 1848 Dublin. And I'm like, who the hell is this guy? And the Governor Schweitzer looks at me and he says, you know, you call yourself an Irish American and you don't know who Thomas Francis Marr is? And I did not, nor did, as it turned out, most Americans. And it's interesting because he was at one point the most famous Irish American. I argue that not until John F. Kennedy came along in the 1960s was there an Irish American more better known than Thomas Marr. So one of the things I was trying to do is rescue him from the myths of history. But the great thing from a storyteller perspective, Doug, is that on Marr's shoulders, in his short life, you can tell that Irish American story, starting with the attempt to erase them as a people, going through the famine, going through oppression, going through banishment, going through immigration, going through their blood sacrifice, trying to become Americans, and finally ending up in Western settlement and trying to find hope and new life on the sunset side of the Mississippi River. And so I just lit up. I go, my God, here's our story in one incredibly gripping life. So again, if you're open to these things happening to you, sometimes they will happen.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that there's this question that persists, I think. What was it about the Irish? Why were they seen for so many years as such a pariah? And you really sum it up in the book in one really succinct sentence. In many ways, it all began because they refused to be English.
Exactly. So for almost 700 years, I'm going up to Mars time because it's 800 if you go up to Ireland finally became a free state in the 20th century. For almost 700 years going up to Mars' birth, it was essentially a crime to be Irish. And I'll just go through real quickly the litany of things. They made it a crime to play your sport, which was hurling. They made it a crime to speak your language, which was Gaelic. They made it a crime to practice your faith, which was Roman Catholicism. They made it a crime to play your music. So they outlawed the harp, which, you know, people wonder why the harp is on the Guinness bottle of beer, or the harp was on the Irish flag when they founded the Irish Brigade during the Civil War. It's because it was a martyr's instrument. It was something that the Brits took. Queen Elizabeth said in the 15th century, round up the harpers wherever they are found and hang them. So they did everything they could to deculturalism, to ethnically cleanse them. We didn't have that term. They took away their land. They took away their language, everything. Now, the British Empire, when Mark is born in 1823, it's the most powerful empire on earth. The Union Jack flies over one-fourth of the earth's surface. And the most ungovernable part of all of that is 30 miles away in right. tiny little Ireland. Yeah. And they have a bigger brigade of troops in Ireland than they do in the subcontinent of India. That's, you know, the relationship. So yeah, they just saw the Irish as these ungovernable, tribal, clannish. They spoke a different language. They worshipped a different god. They just saw them as a sort of other.
Yeah, they wouldn't assimilate. It seems like that was
right.
It seems like there are these endless stories of atrocities, and you tell some of them in the book. And among the worst seem to be those undertaken by the English political and military leader Oliver Cromwell. Would you mention a little bit about that? Because you say in the book that Cromwell was only in Ireland for something like 9 months, but this is how you put it. He imprinted himself on every Irish family.
I remember as a little kid growing up and hearing my grandmother, you know, the curse of Cromwell be on you. And to this day, de Tocqueville, when he toured Ireland after touring America, has found that in every little village, the worst thing you could say to another Irish person was the curse of Cromwell be on you. So he came through and basically burned, pillaged, plundered, you know, killed women, children, and men with equal, you know, fervor, said God was on his side. And after conquering most of Ireland, he took most of the land and gave it to his soldiers, and those soldiers gave it to their descendants, which is why, you know, most Irish didn't live on their land. They were peasant farmers. But he also sent 40,000 people into slavery in the Caribbean, mostly in Barbados. So there was a great story in Irish American magazine not long ago about the descendants of these Irish slaves. They weren't sent as indentured servants. They were sent as actual slaves, 40,000 of them. So the memory lingers. it's a memory of cruelty. It's a memory of oppression. It's a memory of land taking away. And no one was worse at it than Oliver Cromwell.
And it seems like there's another theme here, at least that I identified, where Thomas Francis Marr comes to feel this kind of affinity between his people and the slaves of the American South. It eventually had to come to it because he was he had to be convinced about slavery being a bad thing when he came to the United States, and we can talk about that.
Exactly.
But there was that affinity. He did feel that connection.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating dynamic that's with us today. Let me just give you a brief bit of background. So when Frederick Douglass, the freed ex-American slave, orator and newspaper man, toured Ireland during the famine, he was amazed at how well he was treated. He said, quote, "I find myself treated as a man, not as a color." Yeah. And he compared the Irish peasants to the slaves of the American South. But then he noted 10 years later that when those same Irish immigrants had come to America and took all the lousy jobs and were told that if the freed blacks were loose, they would take these jobs, there was a change in attitude. Mm-hmm. So he noticed that the Irish had picked up some American racism once they'd come to the country. Marr himself, as he said, was an agnostic on slavery initially. He said, you know, he was a Democrat, and the Democrats were, you know, it's the law. We might as well not try to change it, is what he said. But he, by the sacrifice that his men gave up, the Irish Brigade in the Civil War, he came to see the great cause of so many Irish. And by the way, no Civil War brigade had a higher casualty rate than the Irish. Excuse me, only two brigades had a higher rate. Mm. He saw that sacrifice as a sacrifice for liberating black men in the United States. And so it was that's the long line that was drawn. And he became way more progressive than most other Irish. At the time, he wanted blacks to become citizens before the 13th Amendment was there. Mm. So he really had this transformation. And he saw that clear line from coming from his country to coming here. But it took him a while.
Yeah. Let's back up a little bit when he was younger. The story you tell of his sort of formation is really fascinating. And words play an important part in this story. As you put it in the book, Thomas Francis Marr was taught to love words and their power to change minds. But there's this initial conflict that he has. His father is wealthy, and his father agrees with him. Yes, the Irish are being oppressed, but son, you've got to work within a system. Things will work out, but just be patient. But Thomas Marr didn't want to be patient, it seems.
Right. So what it was the Irish were allowed to vote, but only if you owned X amount of property and you renounced your religion could you then, up until a certain point. So, you know, only less than 5% of Irish ever had any representation in Parliament. So they clearly weren't. They were ruled by England without any representation. But all those other things I mentioned, taking away their religion, taking away their culture, taking away their land, that was the sort of lead up to the present circumstance. And Marr chafed at that. He was a feisty, prickly individual, though he was educated at the best college in Europe and he spoke five languages. Mm. He said, why are there British warships in harbor in my home port of Waterford? Why are so many people not allowed to speak their language in my own country? Why can't we worship the God of our choice? Why have so many people dispossessed of their land? All those are questions that a young man, especially a young man with the kind of amazing gift of gab that he had, would ask. But furthermore, he then sees the famine, and that, I mean, he sees it, he experiences it, he lives it, and it absolutely radicalizes him and these other young people, men and women, called Young Irelanders, and they were poets, philosophers, lovers of language. You know, they thought sonnets could beat swords. I mean, you have to be young to believe this. The quixotic sense that that right itself and words themselves could take on a mighty empire.
Would you tell the story of him when he's in college? And he lucks out in getting this great role in a production of King Lear. I think it's a great story because it really tells his sense of defiance and really how being Irish was thought of in England and speaking like you were from Ireland.
Right. So he goes to this one of the best schools in England. It looks like Downton Abbey. That's what people say. It still stands. It's called Stonyhurst. It's just this huge pile. At one point, it was the biggest building, they said, in all of Europe. And he's taught by English Jesuits. So they are allowed to learn Roman Catholicism because Britain has liberalized their laws somewhat. But he speaks with an Irish brogue. He's from Waterford. He's from Munster Province, and he speaks with an Irish brogue. He gets this great, because he was so such an extrovert, he gets this great role in a Shakespeare play. And the priest whacks him on the hand and says, if you don't get rid of that brogue, you're going to lose your role. So Barr defiantly continues to speak this way. He loses his role. He's reduced to a lowly bit part.
Right.
But when he comes out on stage to shout his one line, he plays a soldier, he does it in the most overreactive Irish brogue. And he promptly loses, you know, the complete role. And he says it was not the first time that the brogue entailed giving up right of property or position. That, but it was. I'm glad you brought that out, because it was an act of defiance that showed the kind of character he was. That I will not give up who we are to become somebody else.
It was poetry, you say. I want to come back to that before we head into a break. The bend of words to frame a cause, as you put it, that lifted Ireland from this gloom that was going on. This was in the months before the potato blight. And there was this Thomas Davis, and Marr was mesmerized by Davis. He was this poet, and Marr would memorize his words, and he would use these words in his argument. In his arguments, he's a terrific debater. Talk about the idea of poetry, because it seems like you can't disconnect the Irish and their poetry and their words from their cause, it seems.
That's very well stated. I don't know the exact statistics on this, but I've read it, and it's been said repeatedly that there are more writers and poets and bards and tellers of stories in Ireland than almost any place per capita. I certainly know the heritage that I inherited was one where you tell stories and you use words to try to move people. And because they were a minority, people who really had nothing, never had weapons, never had land, storytelling and words themselves became the only power they had. Mm. So at this moment when a little bit of light opens up in the rest of Europe, you know, there's revolutions going on in France and elsewhere, this group of educated young men and women who are the most gifted people of their generation. They're just brilliant poets. You mentioned Davis, who unfortunately dies young, but founds this newspaper called The Nation, which is it's read by everyone as soon as it comes out. The peasants recite the poems. They're poems of nationalism. They're poems of being a people. They're at a time when they've been told they have nothing that links them to their glorious path. These poems are telling them they have pride. They have sense of place. It's sort of like Native Americans passing on their creation myths or singing their songs. So the poetry itself becomes the rallying cry of the Young Ireland movement that grows into an uprising, ultimately a violent and failed uprising. Mm-hmm. But initially, it's thought that they can use these powerful poems against the famine, against English occupation, celebrating the fact that they're a people, an ancient civilization that goes back more than 1,000 years. It's those things themselves to lift a people up. And they're just sort of almost drunk on the power of these words. I mean, Marr's lover, Speranza, was her nom de plume. She became the mother of Oscar Wilde eventually. She wrote these powerful, powerful poems against what the Brits were doing to people during the famine. She also wrote these lovely poems celebrating Marr's beauty and his gift of gab. Right. But so they used words, again, to try to lift themselves out of this gloom. And for a brief moment, Doug, the gloom did lift.
Seems like as a writer, it would have been distracting hearing all these great stories. It seems like you could have gone off on any one of these. And I mean, Jane Francesca Elgee, the Speranza character who becomes Oscar Wilde's mother. That's a book. That's a whole extraordinary story right there.
In fact, there has been a book written about her.
Yes.
So, no, it's discipline, Doug. You have to be disciplined.
Yeah, you have to be disciplined.
That's why I do all my own research, because you get on these wonderful little cubby holes, and I love these little detours.
Did you ever find any proof, by the way, that they had a fling? It seems like they must have.
Yeah, she two things. She wrote just these amazing poems about his beauty, his physical beauty, and his power as an orator and how he stirred people. And then at the same time, she wrote a friend saying, I cannot have a friendship, especially with a man, if it doesn't involve something sexual. I mean, they were a very liberated crowd, to put it in the modern parlance, I guess. And then at his trial, she shows up in this, she was a glamorous figure. She shows up in this just absolutely beautiful outfit and sat through everything. She was brought to see him at the jail, as the cryptic language was, I forget the exact words, but they said at his leisure or something. So that, I think it seems pretty clear they had a tryst while he was awaiting his execution, which I should inform your listeners, for his role in using words against the British Empire, he was sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit.
Timothy Egan is with us. His book is The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the New York Times reporter and columnist Timothy Egan is joining us to tell stories about Thomas Francis Marr. There's a Western twist to the story. Marr ends up in Montana, the Montana Territory, but that was just the last phase of an amazing life. His book is The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero, and he's joining us from Seattle to talk about it. So let's talk about the real story that you write about in terms of the potato famine, the potato blight. By the late 18th century, the potato is the national food. But we need to point out, and this is a really important point, it's a national food for the commoners, for the peasants. And the large estates, the ones controlled, of course, by the English, they had the money crops. They had oats and they had barley and cattle and sheep. I guess potatoes were for the peasants.
That's a very good point. And I was on a panel a few years ago when someone said, you know, those stupid Irish, all they did was grow this monocrop. Didn't they know any better? Of course they got a potato famine because they didn't grow anything but a potato. And I was really offended by that because, first of all, 80% of the Irish at the start of the famine did not own their land. They were peasants. They did live – your average family could live up to a year on an acre's worth of potatoes with a little bit of butter and bacon substituted. It was remarkable what they did on a small amount of it. And yes, the potato did fail spectacularly. But here's the great, largely unknown point about the famine, arguably one of the worst crimes in the history of Europe, is that at the point when a million people did starve to death, when little children shivered with their mothers in ditches with their teeth stained green from gnawing on nettles and dandelions, when families huddled in workhouses looking like absolute scarecrows, more food was exported from Ireland probably than any time in its history. They say that more beef left Ireland than any other part of the British Empire. They did grow money crops of barley and oats and different kinds of grains and cereals. And those crops were raised by Irish hands, but they didn't go into Irish mouths. So the cause of the Young Ireland, of Thomas Marr and his compatriots, was close the ports. Yeah. And Speranza wrote poems about that. And Marr gave speeches before crowds as big as 50,000 people saying, our country is turning into a graveyard while all this food is leaving Ireland. So in 1997, British Prime Minister Tony Blair apologized to the Irish 150 years after the start of the famine, and he said it was one of the great crimes of England. And he sort of acknowledged that, in fact, the potato blight had only been the ostensible cause. And since then, there's been a ton of scholarship, new documents, et cetera, coming out showing the degree to which the British were complicit in allowing this thing to happen. Now, why did they allow this to happen? I mean, they didn't kill a million Irish, but a million Irish died under their governorship at a time of great prosperity in the empire and lots of food in Ireland. Well, they thought that the Irish had bred too fast, that there were too many people, that one of them said, this is God's will, God's way of sort of culling out this overpopulation. There were 8 million people at the time of the famine, and in no time, a million would die and almost 2 million would leave the country. So people now study the famine, as they call it in Ireland, the Great Hunger, and they see so many different lessons for the rest of us, and they see a much broader story than a mere potato blight.
One thing that I hadn't understood was the fact, as you mentioned in the book, that the British ruling class were reluctant to do much to help the Irish, in other words, stop the food exports, because, as you put it in the book, they were enthralled to the idea of unfettered free markets. They didn't want to disturb this magic market.
Right. They were totally enthralled to it. It was an idea that was relatively new, but it took hold in the British governing and merchant class. And most Americans don't know, but the Choctaw Indian Nation sent a ship of Indian corn. And for a while, the British would not let it land in the harbor in Dublin because they thought, oh, here's all this free food. Once you put it into this market, it's going to upset the magic of the free market. When they finally started opening soup kitchens and giving food to the starving to death Irish, they wanted to make them pay for it because they said if they don't pay for it, it will upset the free market. Mm. Now, I'll just quote the Lord Governor General of Ireland, who was a Brit serving the British government. He called that policy, this is his word, not mine, the policy of extermination.
Yeah.
Because it was whether it was upsetting the market or not is debatable. But what we do know is it accelerated to the death of the people.
Dependence on charity is not to be made an agreeable mode of life. Charles
Trevelyan, exactly
this
right.
English nobleman. I mean, so this was a social experiment.
Yeah, and there's if any of your listeners ever get to Quinnipiac University in Connecticut, there's it's called the Great Hunger Museum. It's a relatively new museum. It's a terrific museum, but there's a portrait of Lord Trevelyan, who was the British minister in charge of the famine, alleviating the famine, and beneath this portrait in the museum in Quinnipiac are the words, "Wanted for crimes against humanity." And that's the Irish view of Lord Trevelyan, because he didn't want to upset the free market rather than let people starve. Like as I said, the Choctaw Indian Nation sent corn. So did people in Calcutta, India. Mm. Charity was coming in from all over, and they were more concerned about the upsetting the market than people dying in the streets.
Well, of course, Thomas Mar was not hanged and not drawn and not quartered, but he was sent to – and this is such a fascinating part of the book, and I don't want to give too much away, but let's talk about his experience on the island of Tasmania, because this is such a great part of the story, because he arrives there and he's entranced by the beauty of this place. I mean, the natural beauty of the place is extraordinary, and they trust – some of these people to not, you know, they say, look, don't escape, sign this. I think they called it a ticket of leave, right?
Yes.
And you can stick around and you can have a horse, right, and you can have a dog and you can kind of wander around this pretty place. There's not a lot to do. But would you talk about Tasmania? Because this is a great part of the story.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up, because to me this is one of the most fascinating parts to research. So Thomas Mar's life is basically five epochs. The second one is now Tasmania. Now, England was trying to build a penitentiary out of a continent. You know, Australia had only been newly discovered by Europeans. It really was Mars. It was so far away. It took 9 months to get there. It was more than half the circumference of the Earth in terms of distance. Mm. So Mars' sentence is commuted to lifetime banishment to Tasmania. Now, the Brits sent 160,000 people, mostly petty criminals, you know, accused of stealing a loaf of bread or taking a bolt of clothing, or they sent a lot of orphans there too, little orphan kids. They just put them on the ship. This was how they populated Australia with petty criminals. Mm. But Tasmania was a special place. That's where the political prisoners were sent. So the brightest, wittiest, most eloquent, most educated political prisoners, the class of young Ireland, is suddenly sent to spend the rest of their life in the island of Tasmania. And as you mentioned, Doug, they had to take what was called a gentleman's code. If they told the governor general that they would not escape, they were allowed to have a little tiny district where you lived and you could have a farm and a cabin. And Mar lived there. The greatest orator in Ireland is reduced to talking to his dog.
Yeah.
And he's incredibly lonely. He's 26 years old. He feels like his life is absolutely ended. He'll never see Ireland again. He's all alone in this island, this little farm district. But to get to your point about the escape, so again, I don't want to give it away, but I'll tell you this because you touched on it. He was a gentleman.
Yeah.
And under the Victorian code of being a gentleman, he sent a note to the governor general saying, "I, Thomas Francis Maher, hereby notify you that as of noon tomorrow, I intend to escape from this god-awful place. And this is to give you my notice of my plan to escape. Faithfully yours, Thomas Francis Maher." So to keep his gentleman code, he notifies them that he plans to escape. And they send a bunch of troops up to grab him, and he gets on his horse with some Aussies who are helping him with his escape, and he rears up and he says, "I'm Thomas Francis Maher. Catch me if you can." And off he goes into the Tasmanian wild.
It's a great story. Suffice it to say, he makes his way to New York City. And one of the things I've heard you say is in some way, the way some Americans think of Mexicans today is how Americans in that time thought of the Irish. Would you talk about that immigration idea? Because this is also a theme, it seems, in the book.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I like to time travel so much is because you pull things from the past that have so much relevance and excitement to today. And when I started researching Irish immigration, which, you know, everybody thinks they know a little bit about, sure, the famine happened and then the Irish came ashore, I did not realize the extent to which our history has since then repeated itself. So real quickly, the Irish were the first real wave, ethnic wave of people to come to our country. There would later be Italians, Southern Europeans, Eastern European Jews, Asians. African Americans, of course, were brought by force as slaves, but people from all over the world would come and there would be different reactions. But the Irish were the first to take the brunt of this. And they came ashore. Most of them never went more than a few blocks from where they landed. They were rural people who were just suffering from absolute culture shock. And they did commit a lot of petty crimes. So they actually filled the jails of New York City. And you know the term paddy wagon? You know, that was invented to the vehicle they used to round up the Irish. The term hooligan was a term that came about to talk about, oh, these damn Irish, they're such petty criminals. So they did not quite fit. They were out of place in this new country of ours. And so for the first time in our history, following this great immigration wave, we had a huge backlash to it. And a party was founded called the Know-Nothing Party. That's what they were formerly known as. And they rose to be the second most powerful party in the United States. Their entire platform was anti-immigration and more specifically anti-Irish. So they burned Irish Catholic churches. They burned Irish Catholic parishes. They burned an Irish Catholic firehouse in Philadelphia. They passed laws making it almost impossible for Irish to become citizens. They called them scum. They called them murderous. They said they were criminals. So Maher himself, remember, the most illustrious Irish American of his day, is a convict. He's got a price on his head. He's wanted by the British Empire. So when we heard Donald Trump say of Mexicans that they're rapists, they're criminals, they don't send their best people, I saw that speech. I read that speech. I saw the same thing in the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s. They used that very language, except for you substitute the word Mexicans for Irish.
And there's this kind of cruel irony in twist to this story that the Irish came to be afraid that liberated slaves would take their jobs. This is an irony, as you mentioned, Frederick Douglass sort of points out, that they themselves are oppressed and then they sort of turn there. This was not a great part of the Irish story,
no,
but one you have to point out, I guess.
Absolutely, and I'm more than willing to point it out, and it shows it's a universal theme of human nature. So when Douglas visits Ireland, he sees the people who are open to blacks. Later, he sees these Irish come here and they change. What happens? Remember, they were rural, mostly illiterate peasant people fleeing a disaster.
Yeah.
Many of them arrived as orphan teenagers because their parents died in the coffin ships on the way over. Some of them were petty criminals. What did they do? They swept the streets of manure. They took care of other people's babies. They dug the canals of upstate New York. They dug the sewage system of the cities. They later built the subway systems. They had all the jobs that no one else wanted. And they were told, remember, the United States was the largest slaveholding nation on earth on the eve of the Civil War. 4 million people were held in human bondage. And they were told if these 4 million people were freed, they're going to come up and take your jobs. So there was a huge split in the Irish community as to whether they should fight for the North. Marr instantly seized on joining Abraham Lincoln, who was his political rival. Marr was a Democrat. And he said, how could we think of anything but fight for the Union cause? He said, this is the nation that has given us refuge. England doesn't care for us. No other country has ever taken us in. And he then came to embrace the cause of slavery, as we mentioned earlier. And it cost him in the Irish community. People turned against him. He went from being considered a savior, as he was called when he arrived, to being in some quarters a pariah. But he also was a general. I don't want to get ahead of that, but he also was a general. So he was a hero. And he was a pariah.
Timothy Egan is with us. His book is The Immortal Irishman, the Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. And we'll take another quick break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Timothy Egan. We're talking about his book, The Immortal Irishman, the Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. So after reading this section in your book, I went and found John F. Kennedy's speech before the Irish Parliament in 1963. Almost 100
years. A few months before he was killed, assassinated.
Right. And I want you to talk about this story. It's 100 years after the Battle of Fredericksburg, where the Irish Brigade plays such an extraordinary part in that battle. And would you tell that story? It's really great.
Sure. So what Kennedy – it was a very triumphant return for a Prince of Ireland, you know, someone whose family had fled during the famine, to send a descendant back as a president of the most powerful nation on earth. It was a great closing of the circle and a great – probably the high point in Irish-American history when Kennedy visits Dublin and tours the countryside in 1963, a few short months before he himself is killed. And what does he want the Irish people to know? He speaks before the Irish Parliament. He wants them to know the story of Thomas Marr and Fredericksburg. So he brings with him the green flag of the Irish Brigade during the Civil War. It's a harp and a sunburst on a green flag, and they became such – their reputation was such brilliant warriors that Robert E. Lee himself said whenever we saw that, quote, that damn green flag, right, he knew it meant trouble. But it's actually a horrible thing what happened to them at Fredericksburg, and it's what broke Marr's heart as a general. So he'd recruited all these people from the slums of Boston and New York on the idea that this is how we can show the know-nothings that we'll be citizens. This is how we'll show the people who hate us that we're true Americans, but also that maybe one day they can then sail across the Atlantic and liberate their homeland from England. But they just get slaughtered, and Fredericksburg is the worst. So it's a hill that the Irish Brigade was told to take, and it's just before the battle, Marr tells his soldiers to take a little pinch of green from boxwood and put it under their forage caps, which the Civil War soldiers wore. He said, so when they find our bodies, they'll know we died as Irishmen. And so they march up this hill in formation, and they just get mowed down. They make several attempts to take what was called Mary's Heights in Fredericksburg, and they just get brutally, brutally slaughtered. Marr himself is knocked from his horse during this battle, and there of 1,200 people who tried to take that hill from the Irish Brigade, something like only 280 survived. And And Mars is broken by this. He just weeps because he knows these faces. He knows these people. But this is the story that Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, wants the people of Ireland to know, is that, you know, your people, our people, left as refugees, fleeing this horrible crime of this famine. But they, by their sacrifice for other people, for black slaves, for this union of the United States, they became better people. That's the one takeaway story Kennedy wants them to know. And he goes through this litany of horror and misery because, you know, as Senator, the late Senator Moynihan said, to be Irish is to know that the world will always break your heart. And Kennedy touched on that breaking of heart, that misery. But he also said, you know, don't forget your past, and your past is people like Marr who gave this sacrifice. And it's really a remarkable moment. I'm glad you went back and looked at it because some people have forgotten that visit by a long ago son of Ireland.
And he unveils the flag. He gives them the flag. It's a great moment. Yeah, you should check it out if you have a chance. So he goes back to New York after the war. A friend finds him. This sounds like a beautiful brownstone on East 23rd Street.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like an amazing place with this. Sounds like a great library. And, this is another one of those moments where you figure, all right, he's going to be content and just sort of settle in and make a place. But here again, he's restless. He doesn't stick around.
Right. And just to back up, he is up marrying a woman who's sort of everything the Irish are not. She's a daughter of great colonial wealth. She's a Anglo-Saxon. He's a Celt. She's a Protestant. He's a Roman Catholic. He's a fugitive. She is a, you know, Fifth Avenue debutante. But her name is Elizabeth Townsend from the Townsend family. And she just absolutely falls for this Irish fugitive. And they remain close for the rest of their lives. And after the war, Marr goes back to that brownstone, and he could have led a life as a New York barrister in the same way he could have been this sort of Prince of Waterford at the dawn of the famine. But he always said he wanted to make his mark. He wanted to put a dent in history, and that dent would be, you know, somehow liberating his people. But this opportunity arises. Someone comes up with this idea. Actually, the American ambassador to Great Britain comes up with this idea of creating a place called New Ireland in the American West. In the same way that we have a New England, a New Jersey, a New South Wales, they would get the Irish masses out of the terrible tenements on the East Coast cities and move them to the open skies of the American West. And the ambassador suggests, and why don't we name General Marr as the governor of this new territory of New Ireland? Now, just to be clear, it's an American territory. What they chose the place would be, it would be Montana Territory. So it's totally under the U.S. flag. But the idea was that you would get these immigrants out of the cities.
Right.
So Marr eventually goes west to take up this latest chapter in his life with his beloved wife, Libby, who joins him later.
And to make some money, which I think is – I mean, because this is the thing that I'm trying to find my list here of his possessions when he makes his way to Montana. A couple of horses, a stovepipe, some champagne, some cigars. I mean, he doesn't have a whole lot. And I think you mentioned that aside from politics, he's also trying to make a little bit of money for himself.
Right, because though his father is wealthy, he gets none of this money.
Yeah.
I mean, he never was able to go back to Ireland. He makes his money as a speaker and fills large halls, but he hasn't given a speech in a long time. He's been working as a Civil War general. So when he arrives in Montana territory as the number two person, the secretary, he has nothing. And he had even said in his wonderful note he wrote to his beloved Libby when he was asking for her hand in marriage, he said, "I have nothing." He said, "I am here alone." The word he uses, "I'm a homeless exile. I'm a fugitive." But he said, "If you will take me as your husband, you know, there's no more person I will be closer to." So he arrives in Virginia City, Montana, which is about 6,000 feet in elevation. It's this godforsaken, deadwood kind of town. I mean, you can picture, you know, manure in the streets and drunks lolling about and lopsided homes. It's not the picture of a perfect idyllic settlement.
Right.
It's this raw-boned, really rough town. And the great orator of Ireland shows up, and the day he arrives, the then governor is standing there with his in his Sunday school clothes with his kids. He hands him a sheath of papers and says, "You're now governor. I'm out of here." and he gets on a stage and is never seen again. So Marr then becomes that day the territorial governor of an area about five times larger than Ireland. Mm-hmm. So this fugitive, arguably the most wanted fugitive of the British Empire, is now governor of a territory, this huge Montana territory. And there starts the final chapter of his life.
Yeah. I want to back up just a tad to the point where he stops in Salt Lake City briefly before he – I think before he gets to the Montana region, because you write a little bit about this where he's, right. You say, greeted as a hero there to – and this is how you put it – there to release them from the theocratic hold of Brigham Young. I guess he wasn't here very long, but what was his experience like here?
Right. Well, just to back up, remember that the Irish were drawn to the mines of the West. So there were a lot of mining jobs in Utah Territory in the same sense that what became Butte, Montana, that's where my great-grandfather came, that those mining jobs is what drew them. So there was a good cluster of Irish and later Italians in Utah. And they felt, you know, completely under the glove of what they call the theocratic rule of Brigham Young. I mean, these Mormons to them were clannish. To the Mormons, the Irish were clannish. But the point is they didn't get along. And they went their separate ways. And they – I mean, they got along eventually. But at the time, it was – the Irish felt really kept out of the closed society that Young had in Utah Territory. So Marr, as he's making his way west – they're telegraphing ahead in the same way after his escape. They were saying, Thomas Marr about to arrive on American shores. He'll be the savior of the Irish masses. As he's making his way west, they're telegraphing the news that the great Irish general is now coming to the American West. And so when he arrives in Salt Lake, he only has a brief stopover. There's a huge crowd that greets him, and they want him to stay there. No, don't go to Montana. Stay here and liberate us, lead us, you know. And so – but he has his appointment to the north, and he has to then cross a few more pretty high mountain passes to the extraordinarily isolated place of Virginia City in Montana.
What did you conclude, Timothy Egan, about what he made of the West? I mean, so much different from Ireland, obviously, so much different from Tasmania, so much different from the East. Did he ever see this place as home? I mean, there's a letter that he writes to a friend that you quote where he says, "I'm resolved not to turn my back on the Rocky Mountains until I have the means to whip my carriage through the New York Central Park and sail my yacht within 3 miles of the Irish coast." So he's going to move on, it sounds like. The West is a stopping off point maybe.
Yeah. Also, you hear in that statement, I'm glad you read that, classic Marr hint of defiance that he was going to take his yacht to within – no, he wasn't allowed into Ireland.
Right.
But he would go within 3 miles and sort of shout at them, you know, and remind England that he's still around. That's just that defiant Marr wanting to be – he was insecure as well, like as a lot of people are. It's unknown whether he would have stayed there. I also found some things where he talked about how the beauty of the Rocky Mountains really uplifted him. And he gave some speeches where he thought the Irish – he wrote letters to other Irish saying, come here.
Yeah.
This is where we can actually find ourselves as a people. He thought they could have some dignity, have a home, a hearth, and a place. And as I said, my great-grandfather was one of those who took up the call of New Ireland and came to Butte, Montana. So I want to point out a little known of the many little known facts about this amazing character. In the official history – of Yellowstone National Park, not my history, but the official history written by the National Park Service. This, by the way, shocked the hell out of me. Governor Marr is credited with being one of the first people, and this is in the 1860s, with suggesting that Yellowstone should be a park of some sort. So, you know, he does have that say, and he does think that people can start fresh away from these horrible tenements, that the land itself will make them better people. So I think it's inconclusive as to whether, you know, he did come to really like the Rocky Mountain West, but he always felt lonely too. He always felt sort of disconnected from, you know, the rest of society. Also, one more thing. He was then a member of the Fenian Brotherhood, which was a group that had taken a pledge to do anything they could to liberate their country. And there was talk of invading Canada. So there were British agents in Montana Territory, remember, looking for this fugitive who in England they now thought was going to organize the Irish masses throughout the Rocky Mountain West. I mean, that's what they wrote in these British papers. They're like, oh, my God, here's Marr again. But now he's making mischief in the Rocky Mountain West. And they thought he was going to raise a Fenian army, invade Canada, use that as leverage to liberate Ireland. It sounds crazy, I know, but it made sense in the context of the times.
We'll leave the mystery of his death a mystery, at least. You have a terrific theory that you have evidence for it, that you work out in the book, and we'll sort of leave it at that for people to read. I want to ask you this finally, because you write about the burden of memory, how Marr, even at his most joyous points, when he was a speaker, for example, at a banquet, he would always say there's this skeleton at the feast, and that skeleton is that burden of memory. Would you say something about that finally? Because I think this is an interesting theme as well.
Well, I'm so glad, and actually I have to tell you, I'm really touched that you brought this up, and I haven't heard that in a lot of interviews, and I do appreciate it, because it struck me as I was writing my book that this was the theme, that why are all the songs when you go back to Ireland or you play, you go into a pub and you, why are these songs about martyrs and rebels and people who died in earlier campaigns of oppression? Why are the great epic poems, why are so many of William Butler Yeats' best lines of verse about a resiliency of spirit against a history of oppression? You know, what is that all about? Well, and I think I got this in my own family, that I heard these stories because you have a responsibility to your heritage to not forget this. And that's why I think he always fought against injustice. I think that's why he came around so strongly on African-American slavery. That's why he fought the vigilante forces in Montana, is because he said, as an Irishman, I inherit this. I have a responsibility to not let this history die, to make this history, to make it somehow active in my life, to translate that burden of memory, that skeleton at the feast, into something positive. And I think every Irish man or woman or child who knows their history well, and consider there are almost 70 million people now worldwide in the global Irish diaspora, they carry that burden of memory. That burden is our history itself.
Timothy Egan, his book is The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero, joined us today from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle. Timothy, thank you very much for the time.
It was delightful, and thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.